In Illinois, police can confiscate your car, cash, even home if they believe it's connected to a crime, even if you're not convicted. A bill waiting for the governor's signature would limit the practice. We'll find out where that stands. Plus, many colleges assign books to incoming freshmen to spark conversation when students get to campus.
It gives them a common intellectual experience before they even arrive on campus, to give them things that they can talk about with and connect with each other in an academic way outside the classroom, even with people that they're not sharing classes with.
Colleges across the state join us to share which books they've selected and why. And President Trump tweeted last month that transgender service members will be banned from the U.S. military. That worries people in the military, like Lyneth Starr.
My heart basically dropped the moment that I read that, because here was the head of the organization that I had spent my whole life being dedicated to, out of the blue, implying that I was going to be thrown out.
We'll hear from transgender veterans in the Midwest. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, in for Nyla Boodoo. Last month, Attorney General Jeff Sessions restarted a federal program that allows local police departments to seize cars, homes, money, other property if police believe it played a role in committing a crime. Some of the money from the program would go back to local police agencies. This is what's known as civil asset forfeiture, as roots in the war on drugs back in the 1980s. Proponents say it's an essential tool to fight crime. Others say it's misused too often. It can hurt innocent people. Here in Illinois, a bipartisan group of legislators sent the governor a bill that would, among other things, limit the use of civil forfeiture in the state. What drove those changes in Illinois? How does a revamped federal program fit in with state policies? And how do local police departments plan to deal with this going forward? I'm joined now on the line by Senator Don Harmon, Democrat, representing Illinois' 39th district. That includes parts of Cook and DuPage County and the west suburbs of Chicago. And from Lamont, about 45 minutes southwest of Chicago, Mark Mayton, chief of police there. Senator Harmon, Chief Mayton, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having us.
Well, thank you for having us on the show.
Senator, let's start with you. You know, we talked about this back in April on this show. Quite a bit has changed since then. I mean, where does your bill that we talked about then to limit civil forfeiture in Illinois, where does that stand right now?
Well, we passed the bill with a bipartisan coalition, and it was due in large part to the cooperation of our friends in law enforcement who joined us at the negotiating table and worked collaboratively with us on a real reform that will change the way civil asset forfeiture is done in Illinois. Not to end the practice, but to make sure that it is fair to the people impacted. We didn't take the tool away from law enforcement, but we enacted a series of common sense reforms that will make it more understandable to the general public, particularly more understandable to the folks who are directly impacted, especially the innocent owners of property whose car or house may have been used, for instance, by a relative. Mm-hmm. I think for all of the changes, the most important one we made related to the burden of proof. Mm-hmm. While the initial bill required that someone be convicted of a crime, we reached an accord with both sides that said instead, under the current law, before the bill is signed, the law enforcement has to show a court that there is a probable cause that the property was used in a crime, and then the owner has to come in and prove that it wasn't. And we thought that was just fundamentally unfair. So we struck a balance. We reached a compromise that says the burden of proof remains with the government. The government has to come in and prove by a preponderance of the evidence standard that the property was used in a crime or was the proceeds of a crime, and then they can proceed with forfeiture.
So
that
Chief,
will have a real impact on the people who are impacted by this.
So, Chief, what do you make then of that change? It adds a little higher bar to that process there. Do you support that change?
We do. And when Senator Harmon came to us and talked to the law enforcement community about the reforms that he wanted to do, we understood that even though we felt that most of the process was occurring properly and that enough safeguards did exist for innocent owners and defendants, that there was a perception that there wasn't adequate due process. So we supported tightening up those due process claims. And the bill does a lot of things. It gives additional due process for respondents. It does shift that burden. In the past, the state had to show by probable cause that the item was forfeitable. Now, in addition to that, it has to show by preponderance that the person was the owner of the property and that some additional burdens that the subject, that the property should be forfeited.
So if just to explain that a little bit further, I mean, if somebody is, if I'm driving my car and I am a participant in a crime, my car then could potentially be seized. You know, what about if it's my car being used by somebody else and I don't know that they might be committing a crime? How does that play out in this?
Right. With the new bill, the state would have to show that you did have either knowledge or should have had knowledge that vehicle was used. And there's additional and expedited due process for vehicles, specifically for innocent owners, and generally for protections for innocent owners, that they can now require a specific hearing for due process within 28 days.
Okay, so within a time limit there. Chief, I think a lot of people, you know, they don't necessarily understand civil forfeiture. It's kind of out there. It's been discussed. It seems like a very technical kind of term. Why is this an important tool for your job in law enforcement?
Well, I think asset forfeiture has been long recognized as an essential tool for combating the very worst criminals, which are violent, organized criminal organizations, drug traffickers and gangs, whose leaders insulate themselves from prosecution and by funneling their profits through money launderers and couriers, and sophisticated criminals engage in crime principally, if not exclusively, for profit. And this hits the organizations where it hurts, to disincentivize the profit motive.
By taking that money, and then where does that money?
Where
does that money go? How is that distributed and then used?
Well, at the state level, the formula is 65% goes back to the seizing agency, 10% to the state police, 12.5% each to the state attorney's office and the appellate prosecutor's office. And then there are guidelines for the use of that. It is to be used for supplementing the agency's efforts at drug enforcement.
Okay. And Senator Harmon, so we talked about a number of the changes here, and it raises the bar in a number of different ways, adds some protections, things like that. You also mentioned this was kind of a compromise. Do you think that the current bill as it stands sitting on the governor's desk goes far enough?
I certainly think it goes far enough for now, and we'll evaluate how it unfolds. But it addresses the two main issues, in my view, that riled up the people living in my district and across the state. One is that notion of the innocent owner who gets caught up in this web. You know, we've heard several stories, you know, the grandmother whose grandson borrowed the car.
Yeah, the 70-year-old grandmother.
Over.
Yeah.
His friend has a joint in his pocket, and that suddenly triggers a forfeiture. Now, that may be one case out of 100, but it's the case that draws your attention to the flaws in the system. The second is what the chief was just talking about. And one of the reasons I think law enforcement was so quick to embrace this reform, there are a handful of bad actors, a couple of departments who spent money from asset forfeitures on things that didn't make sense, and it caught a lot of attention. And so we tightened up the guidelines as to what the proceeds can be used for to supplement local law enforcement efforts. And that's important. People need to understand that this is a valid law enforcement tool, and it's not policing for profit, so that the police departments can buy, you know, fancy new SUVs with all sorts of bells and whistles. It's not designed to reward people in law enforcement for doing their job. It's intended to supplement their efforts to crack down on crime.
And Chief, do these changes give you the flexibility you need? Do they make it harder to fight crime?
Before we go into that, just to follow up on the senator's comments, yeah. What this bill also does is it increases the reporting to the Illinois State Police and provides significant oversight that was lacking previously, so that each agency now will be required to report to the Illinois State Police on what they've seized and what they're using their expenditures for. And it gives the that department authority to suspend sharing if the agencies are not complying with the statute. It also adds a lot of transparency into it, so that agencies or the citizens will be able to look online and see everybody's seizures and the use of that money.
So a lot of transparency there built in. Do you think there's also enough accountability then when there are sort of the bad apples, as the senator said there? Is there enough accountability now built in?
Yeah, I think the senator built in an adequate accountability and provided the Illinois State Police that oversight and the annual reporting, so that they're going to be looking at that, and there's going to be an annual audit required by each agency to make sure they're complying with those standards.
Okay, just briefly, and I suppose, Senator, I'll direct this question to you. Can you just explain that process of what does happen after someone's property is seized? Again, just an overview, you know, how do you get it back or not?
Well, the chief could probably give you some more nuts and bolts on the ground, being a participant at times. The stories that we were hearing is, you know, someone's pulled over, the car is seized, there's a probable cause hearing, it triggers the forfeiture process. And then you have the owner of the car who wasn't at the scene, doesn't know what happened. They've got to go to court and prove that they didn't know that their car was being used in a crime, or that it wasn't used in a crime, which is hard to do. These are also, in at least in the innocent owner circumstances, a context where they're walking into a very unfamiliar and frightening place. And again, I really give a lot of credit to the state's attorneys who negotiated this for recognizing that folks without any real courtroom experience were walking into their home court, mm-hmm. and expected to compete with their rules. So we've done this expedited process, and especially for the folks who are claiming innocent owner status, it's not a precise analogy, but it's more the equivalent of a small claims court, where you can go in without a lawyer, and the circumstances are much more designed to accommodate that kind of a party coming into court.
Okay. And Senator Harmon, this is all happening in Illinois, and obviously the bill was in process in parallel then. The Department of Justice in Washington revived a policy, lets local police use federal law to confiscate property in some cases, and then potentially some of that money coming back to those agencies. Does that raise any concerns for you about that shift for the Department of Justice?
Absolutely. This undermines real reforms at the federal level, primarily during the Obama era. It threatens the bill that we just passed. Now, the chief could correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think there's anything in federal law that compels local law enforcement agencies to partner with the federal government on forfeiture. This equitable sharing program that the federal government has revived is optional. And I would hope that most law enforcement agencies in Illinois, having been full partners in this reform, would embrace it and would use the Illinois model. But it poses the risk that a rogue department who wants to do things the old way would find a shield in Attorney General Sessions' recent announcement.
Chief, do you see that happening? Is there a situation you could imagine where it would be necessary for law enforcement?
I will tell you that the federal government reformed their procedures in 2008 under the CAFRA, which was their Reform Act. And neither Attorney General's letters have much change in Illinois. So the 2015 directive that was put out by Attorney General Holder didn't change a lot of what how asset forfeiture was occurring in Illinois. And it didn't put a blanket prohibition on it. It just said that any adoptions would be had to be approved first by the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Mm-hmm.
So the cases that typically went to the U.S. Attorney were still going to the U.S. Attorney, which were typically the larger cases, the cases where there were drug task force agents, federal drug task force agents, and joint cases with the federal government. So that was already continued to occur since 2015. This action that Attorney Sessions put out isn't going to really change that, because typically most smaller seizures go through the state level. The larger seizures go through the federal level. That's been occurring. It'll continue to occur. So in Illinois, at least, I don't see that either letter had that much practical impact on our
agencies. Would your message be, it can be difficult to walk sort of a line between differing state and federal policies to some degree. Would your message to law enforcement from just your perspective at least be to stick with the Illinois law, or do you think there's a need to explore that federal policy and in some cases maybe bypass the Illinois policy law, if it becomes law, I should say, it's a bill right now?
No, I think that in most cases that most agencies have a relationship with their local state attorney's office. There's already a process in place, and typically we don't look at the federal, at least from a smaller agency perspective, at the federal government typically because we don't run across seizures that, you know, rise to those levels or are sophisticated money laundering. Typically, the Chicago Police and the Illinois State Police, you know, operate in that arena, and they've continued to interact with the federal government, and I think they continue to do that.
Yeah, just a difference of scale there. Senator Harmon, just coming back to you here, we've only got about a minute left here, unfortunately, but you talked about it. I actually misspoke there and called it a law, and it is still a bill. It's sitting on the governor's desk. There's a lot going on in the state, SB1, and a lot of negotiations. Any word from the governor, or do you know if he plans to sign it?
I have not heard directly, but I will tell you that the coalition that spearheaded this was an odd coalition of really progressive Democrats and really libertarian Republicans. We kind of went all the way around the circle and met on the other side. So I would hope, especially with the governor's new advisors who have been very vocal in their support for asset forfeiture reform, that he would sign the bill.
All right, Senator Don Harmon, Democrat, 39th District of Illinois. I also heard Chief Mark Maton there on the line, Police Chief, Village of Lamont, just 45 minutes or so southwest of the Chicago area. Thank you both. I appreciate the time today.
Thank you. Thanks, Chief, for being here.
Support for the 21st comes from the School of Social Work at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, preparing tomorrow's leaders to be advocates for and agents of social change. More information at socialwork.illinois.edu.
I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. Before heading off to campus for the first time, college freshmen are joining new student Facebook groups, picking up last-minute supplies, and for many, reading their campus's shared book selection. Many colleges assign shared reading across the country and certainly here in Illinois. One book or common reading or summer assignments, books that often have a message that might deal with current events or topics, maybe use to spark a conversation when students get to campus. We're going to talk with several colleges about the books that they chose this year across the state and what they hope students get from their programs. We're joined now on the phone by Harry Fisher. He's an associate professor at Eureka College. It's about 20 miles east of Peoria. Also, Nancy Taylor Porter on the line with us, professor at Illinois College in Jacksonville, Illinois, about 35 miles west of Springfield. Also, Tim Foster, associate dean of Knox College in Galesburg, in northwest Illinois. All three of you, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So we've got a big panel here, which is good for talking books. I think we can sort of hear from each of you and the different books that have been selected and why. But why don't we start first with Nancy? You know, so Illinois College, you have what's called, I think it's the Common Reading Program. Is that right?
That's correct.
And so that's first-year students. What is the program, and what do you hope the students get out of it?
Well, one of the things that we hope they get is an introduction to the kind of reading that they're going to be doing and the kind of writing that they're going to be doing when they arrive here at college. There's also a writing assignment that's associated with it. And we want to introduce them to reading in a way that they will enjoy. I think, as we know, a lot of our current students have not been doing a lot of reading. And so we really want something to draw them in. And that gives them a common intellectual experience before they even arrive on campus, to give them things that they can talk about with and connect to with each other in an academic way outside the classroom, even with people that they're not sharing classes with.
So you've got the intellectual side, as long as also the social side, then, too, to be able to share and sort of and open up shared experiences once they do get to campus. What are they reading this year?
So they're reading Octavia Butler's Dawn, which is a first in a science fiction trilogy that's set in a post-apocalyptic nuclear holocaust world where aliens have rescued the human species. But if the price of rescuing is that the humans have to share their DNA and allow themselves to be altered as a species. So it raises a lot of really interesting questions that get to a lot of different disciplines. For instance, without being too sciencey or technical, it gets into genetic engineering, issues of ethics, issues of leadership, because this one woman is chosen to try to bring the other humans along to explain to them what's happening and give them a chance to survive, of psychology and sociology. So we thought it would give a lot of entry points for discussion.
Interesting. So science fiction, but certainly getting at a lot of issues and themes that are relevant to our times right now. And how does the program work then? So summer assignment before college, do most students participate? Do you know? Are they tested on it? Is there some accountability to it? Or is it more of an informal kind of a program?
Well, we're trying to make it formal, yeah, and that's part of the accountability of the assignment. And we ask professors to create assignments that really try to make students read the whole book, like not allow them to just read one chapter of it and be able to write their whole response.
Do Cliff's notes still exist? But, I don't know.
Yeah, probably. I'm sure they do. Of course, there'll be those students who will figure out how not to read the book and try to write something. But I do find that most of them have engaged at least somewhat, have done some of the reading of it, and many of them read all of the book and enjoy it. And it is a great kind of jumping off point for them into the beginning of the first year seminar.
Yeah, and an interesting selection, it sounds like, too. Tim, coming over to you, Tim Foster, Associate Dean there at Knox College. How does your process work? Is it similar there?
It's actually very similar. We try and choose books that are engaging and relevant and meaningful for first-year students as they make this sort of switch from home life to college life.
And so what's your selection there at Knox?
Well, the title, right, is Make Your Home Among Strangers. It's a book about a Latino woman from Florida that goes to a Northeast small liberal arts college, and sort of the misunderstandings on both sides, what her expectations are and what the college's expectations are.
And it's interesting. It's one of the books that pops up. It's one of the books that pops up quite a bit on the list. You know, Penguin put out a list of hundreds of colleges and universities around the country. It's one of those that pops up, you know, quite a bit across the different campuses.
Yeah, we made this decision maybe 6 months ago, and I was actually gratified to see that maybe we made a good choice this year. You know, it does talk about immigration, which is a very contemporary topic with all the sort of swirling rhetoric about immigrants. And yeah, I think this will reach out to a lot of students that are going to experience exactly what she does, go to a different place and try and make it a home, and build a community around themselves.
And that idea, I mean, even the title, Make Your Home Among Strangers, you know, somewhat relatable perhaps to students coming in and
exactly.
Experiencing a lot of things for the first time.
From the drop-off day. Yeah.
So Harry Fisher with us from Eureka College up there. What book are students going to read there coming into Eureka College?
This year we are using The Most Human Human by Brian Christian.
Hmm.
And it's a book that centers around a contest using the Turing test that pits software programs to determine whether or not a computer can actually think. And then the machine that most often fools the judges gets the Most Human Computer Award.
Is this a warning on technology, or is this what sort of the tone?
I would say there's a warning there, definitely. And I think that it's really important for our students, especially our first-year students, to begin to think about the role that technology is already playing in their lives and how they want technology to be utilized in their future careers.
Yeah, interesting. And then once the students, so that they read this, it's assigned, they come into to campus together here coming up in a few weeks, I would imagine. What's the experience like then? What happens? What kind of programming do you put on campus?
It will actually be the source of a number of discussions in our individual first-year seminar sections. And each of the professors that teaches one of those sections will determine the best way to utilize it. The most common, I think, I will probably have a written assignment or two related to it, probably some quizzes as well to just kind of ensure that everybody's completing the reading. And then I will assign chapters and sections of the book to students and have them actually lead the class in the discussion on the topics And the directions we can go with some of those discussions are truly interesting.
Yeah, I can imagine. And just even the three books that have been selected that we've talked about, very different. They all sort of tie into specific themes that each of you feel is right for the campus and to spark a conversation there. You know, thinking about the process, I'm curious. I mean, it's coming back to Nancy Taylor Porter with Illinois College there. What goes into selecting a book for a campus there, and how important is it to make sure those books somehow speak to the generation of students that are coming in?
I think it's very important, and it's a difficult process. I'm the academic director of the program. I solicit suggestions from people on campus. We had a very spirited discussion this year. It kind of wavers from year to year how much input I get, and I try to put together all those ideas and then make a choice that I feel like sort of fuses the best of them from what I've known about the program. So I think, though, that students, you know, there are some schools that will choose classics, and I think that's great, too. Students certainly should be exposed to those. But they often initially, especially without support of faculty over the summer when they're reading it, they want something that's relatable, that seems fresh, that seems that they can walk into. And that's part of what we did with this book. And its author was one of the first African-American women to achieve international distinction in the science fiction field. And the heroine is an African-American woman, but I believe she's very relatable to lots of different people. And we thought that would also be good for some of the diversity and inclusion projects that we're trying to do on campus.
And so, I mean, that's a good question then. So does that match then and align with other programs on campus to draw more attention, to be more inclusive, to bring in different voices and styles and cultures across the campus?
Absolutely. We have a U.S. diversity component to our general education program. They get introduced to it in the first year seminar. There are sessions that we do later in the semester on U.S. diversity. And we're also bringing in a speaker, Walida Amarisha, who is writing about a book that she has co-edited called Octavia's Brood, which was inspired by Dawn, called Science Fiction and Social Justice, about how people who imagine new worlds are encouraging us to think about how we can do a better job with creating this one.
All right, we're talking about the summer reading program, shared books, one book, campuses, that type of thing as we come back on the new college year. That's Nancy Taylor Porter, co-director of Illinois College Connections at Illinois College. Harry Fisher also on the line, associate professor of business administration at Eureka College. Also Tim Foster, associate dean at Knox College. Just a small sampling here. I mean, North Central College in Naperville is reading Becoming a Learner, Realizing the Opportunity of Education by Matthew Sanders. Illinois Wesleyan reading Between the World and Me. That book also came up across all across the country on campuses by Ta-Nehisi Coates, a book that's gotten quite a bit of attention. Northwestern reading Our Declaration, a reading of the Declaration of Independence in Defense of Equality by Danielle Allen. Also sort of a wide range of books that are out there. Tim, coming back to you there at Knox College, I mean, we talked about that idea. Some campuses are reading more classic type books, Your Catcher in the Rye, Your Grapes of Wrath, things like that. How important is it to balance sort of the old with the new and matching themes, but trying to also remain relevant?
In years past, we've read The Odyssey, for example, was one of the books that was chosen. But I think, it, like Nancy sort of said, it's important that without any sort of context, academic context, it's important to have a really engaging sort of read. With the book we chose, you know, this is a student that's going off to college, and they can put themselves in that person's mind and how she reacts and the problems that she overcomes. They're all very apparent. They're all of those students are wondering what exactly is going to happen in college, and this is one version.
And you know, Harry, coming to you here, you know, Nancy talked a bit about the exposing students to different ideas, different voices, you know, as they come into campus. I mean, do you think that books that celebrate and focus on diversity, do they help to make the environment more welcoming? Particularly, I'm thinking here, you know, of non-white students coming in maybe to a new atmosphere.
Oh, I think that's absolutely true, and I think that we have, utilized some books in that vein in the past. We used The Other Wes Moore a few
also
years back.
Also popular on this list, yeah.
And we actually had Wes Moore come and speak to our students that semester, and so that really, you know, really brought things, to life, I think, for our students. And I think that is one of the goals that can be achieved by having a common reading.
Well, you do something, too, that I hadn't seen out there at Eureka College. I understand that the program is one book over 2 years in a row. So you've got freshmen, sophomores both coming in and reading that same book. What's driving that?
Well, we did that for the first time in the past 2 years. We utilized the curious incident of the dog in the nighttime. And our anecdotal evidence indicated that kind of, you know, in the dormitories, maybe around the supper table and that sort of thing, that there was some discussion of topics from that book between the freshmen and also the sophomores who had read it the previous year, and that maybe created hopefully some useful ties and bonds between, you know, the first-year students and the second-year students.
Tim Foster there at Knox, you know, a lot of these books, they do come with very timely messages and obviously tied to current events, you know, but they also have points of view, sometimes strong points of view. Is there ever concern about picking a book that might be seen to be polarizing on campus? Or is that the idea? Maybe the idea is to spark difficult conversations.
In some senses, you know, I hope that the book is provocative, that it does have a strong point of view. And I think that when people are confronted with that situation, that they need to listen and then respond. And so I really don't think that polarizing is it can be a danger, but I think that in a first-year preceptorial, when people are all experiencing newness, that it's a good time to set down the parameters for how to discuss, how to listen, how to respond.
Yeah, and it comes at a moment of, you know, wide debate across campuses about, you know, the role of speech and civility and things like that. So just
exactly. And this goes not only in the classroom, but also in the wider community and in students' personal lives. We try and pick a book that both the student support services can play off of, and also academically, how we can sort of engender an academic conversation also.
Yeah, and build off of that. You know, time is actually running short already. We only got a little over a minute left. But, you know, Nancy, coming back to you for a moment here, you know, you and Harry both mentioned, you know, having guest speakers come in and talk about these books. How important is that to have events, to have those conversations with the people behind the books to draw people in?
I think it's very important, and our research shows that the students here who are attending convocations, those are some of the favorite convocations that they attend, that it really does make it more real, and it's exciting to them that they've read something that's, then they get to meet the author or someone who's written about the author who's closely connected to the work that's being done. I think it does really bring an element of realness and excitement to the students.
And Harry, similar for you?
Yes, I think those speakers have been very well received by our students and also by the surrounding community as well, because we make those events available, of course, to the general community around the college.
Well, that's probably a good place to wrap up here. I mean, just in the last 15 seconds here, I mean, Harry, do you think that these books can be of use to anybody, not just incoming college freshmen and sophomores?
Oh, absolutely. I think they're excellent topics. I think they can be provocative, and I think that's something that can benefit each of us, regardless of where we find ourselves, whether we're a first-year student or an old professor like myself.
Old Professor Harry Fisher there at Eureka College, Nancy Taylor Porter with Illinois College, and Tim Foster at Knox College. Thank you all. I appreciate the time and the interesting list of books here for your students.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having
me. The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. Last month, President Trump tweeted that transgender service members would be banned from the U.S. Armed Forces. It's been a few weeks now, but the Pentagon still hasn't received guidance on how to enforce the president's statements in the form of any kind of new policy. Just this week, five transgender service members on active duty anonymously sued the Trump administration. They're saying that his ban violates their constitutional rights. There are an estimated 12 to 15,000 transgender troops in the military. That number is hard to track because many have not yet come out. We wanted to take a step back today, talk with transgender veterans here in the Midwest, people who are currently serving and people who have served in the past. Joining me now here is Lyneth Starr, currently serving in the Army National Guard. On the phone with us and here in our Urbana studio, Kathleen Robbins, former Air Force officer. Both of you, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for talking with us and for sharing your stories. Lyneth, starting with you, you're currently serving in the Army National Guard. Why did you originally decide to join? What brought you to the military?
So it's always been a lifelong dream of mine to serve in the military ever since I was a small child. The desire to be seen as someone who did something more with their life to serve and help protect people, those kinds of feelings or emotions or desires have always been a part of me, and that's a big part of why I decided to join the military.
And where did you serve? What kind of roles? What kind of jobs have you had?
So I've had a couple of different roles, working in missile defense systems as well as in communications and also recruiting.
Okay. Kathleen, sort of bringing you into the conversation, I understand you served in Vietnam in the Air Force. What was your path to the military? What brought you? What was the appeal there?
I had hoped to be an astronaut, actually.
No kidding.
And so I went to the Air Force Academy. And 4 years at the Air Force Academy, and then I became a navigator because my eyes weren't good enough for pilot training. Yeah. So I flew in Vietnam for 2 years as a nav on C-130s, doing everything from carrying sick and wounded to dropping 15,000-pound bombs.
We heard Lyneth there talk a little bit of kind of what the military represented, that it just sort of, well, that it represented something, that sort of chance to be seen as something. Was it a similar experience for you?
Yeah. There's two levels to answer that question. Number one is patriotism. I expected to go in the military and serve like that. Mm-hmm. But I think as knowing something was different and transgender wasn't even a word in the 1960s, 1950s, I knew nobody else that was like me at all. There were no TV shows, radio shows, let alone internet. And so I think at some level, it was a good place to run away from. I was an Eagle Scout. I was Air Force Academy. And these were all things that football letterman in high school, all things that could help me run away from the feelings that I had.
You know, Lyneth, I mean, you're listening to this right now and seeing this and hearing all this. I mean, I understand that you recently decided to come out to your unit fairly recently. And with all this that's going on, I mean, what has that experience been like for you?
Yeah, so I came out within the last 8 months to my unit, as well as publicly. And so the coming out experience for me was actually a very positive experience within the military. My unit was very understanding. They immediately got me into touch with individuals that at the state level who knew or had dealt with this situation before with other people. Helped me in getting the necessary counseling in order to begin the transition process. Everybody at my unit has been extremely respectful. I've had people in my chain of command approach me and offer support and encouragement. Not at all what I expected, to be honest.
Yeah, well, I mean, it sounds beating the expectations in the best possible ways there. I wanted to ask you, Kathleen, you wrote a column for the Chicago Sun-Times. You know, you explained you served in the 60s, didn't come out until 1990. You wrote, "I knew only two things. Becoming a woman was impossible, and I better keep my mouth shut if I hope to graduate." Carrying that secret for that long, talking now with Lyneth, who's just sort of beginning down that journey in some ways, you know, what was it like for you to keep that secret and sort of what are your thoughts? I don't want to say advice, but just right now for Lyneth as you talk.
Well, for me, there was a huge psychic cost to carrying that secret that I didn't know existed until I didn't carry this secret anymore. It was, from an energy standpoint, a truth standpoint. Air Force Academy has a motto, integrity first, service before self, and excellence in all we do. And how can you have integrity if you can't be yourself?
I want to ask both of you, at this point, so we've heard a little bit about sort of your stories and what brought you to the military. I mean, how then did you feel when you learned about President Trump's tweet? And Lyneth, I guess we'll start with you.
So, yeah, I woke up in the morning, the day that the tweets went out, to having my phone with about 10 different messages asking me if I had seen what had been said. And so I began looking up, and I remember feeling very, very emotional. My heart basically dropped the moment that I read that, because here was the head of the organization that I had spent my whole life being dedicated to, out of the blue, implying that I was going to be thrown out. This also affected me immensely, because I had been working on going back to active duty status instead of remaining in the Guard, at which obviously would not be able to happen if this ban were to occur.
And have you got any guidance on that front? I mean, have you heard anything from superiors or otherwise about where that's right now? It's still just sort of a tweet in the ether.
Yeah, it's still just a tweet in the ether. According to my superiors in my unit, that day I received a message just stating that basically I took it as a don't panic message, saying that it was just a tweet. There was no policy that had been drafted, and it was not being considered as a new policy until such a thing was drafted and delivered to the head of the DOD.
And Kathleen, how about you when you saw or heard about that tweet?
I was not surprised, but incredibly disappointed. Trump had come out during the campaign and said he was going to be a friend of LGBTQ and people, and I was not surprised that he changed that, given positions of Vice President Pence and that type of thing.
So you were not surprised?
I was not surprised, but very disappointed. I'd also been back to the academy several times, talked to some people that had actually worked on the transition policy for trans in the military, and they were cautioning people to go very slow. That was what they were getting from the White House, or from their command structure, that things were going slow and what's going to happen. But I was really encouraged by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dunsford, and said exactly what Lynette said, just no hurry, nothing has changed, tweets are not policy. Until I get orders, nothing's going to change.
You know, thinking about, Lyneth, what you described with the reaction of your colleagues from your unit, from your superiors there, you know, one of the things that was included in that tweet was the idea of, you know, disruption of the cohesiveness of the unit, the readiness of the unit. Do you see anything or have heard anything that would sort of give credence to that as a legitimate concern right now?
I have, as far as having trans people within the military, I have not. To me, it seems that the push to ban them, if anything, would be causing more damage to unit cohesion than our inclusion in the military. We obviously, you know, we have Kathleen here who served in Vietnam. We've had other trans people throughout history who may not have been able to be public, but we've always been part of the military, and we still are. And now that we are in the military in a public light, it would be that much more damaging to try to get rid of us.
I was at the Air Force Academy when Don't Ask, Don't Tell ended, and LGB cadets came out, and it was a total non-event. It was a total non-event. And
there were similar concerns raised then, too.
And there were similar concerns about mainly cohesiveness of the military and that type of thing. And I think that there's 18 countries, including Israel, Canada, the United Kingdom, Australia, that have trans serving openly in the military. There's not been one iota of mission degradement, cohesiveness, any problems that have happened with that. The cadets that I've talked to, it's just a non-event. There's a New York Times short video by Fiona Dawson, Transgender at War and Love, that I would recommend your listeners to Google and check out, because it talks about two open trans before the ban. This was done in 1915 or 2015, I believe.
Lynette, there was something that you said early on, actually, about that idea of the military kind of representing something. I've heard that before, that the military represents to anybody, you know, to opportunity for college, for career, for respect in some ways. What's lost, I guess, if any particular group can't access those opportunities?
There's the whole concept of everybody having equal opportunity within the United States. One of those opportunities to me is the chance to serve this country in its military. And there are many benefits, obviously, that are provided with that, many opportunities, many, obviously, serving in the military, having an honorable discharge is seen as a status symbol. One of the things that you lose is you lose that sense that the military does, in fact, represent and serve all Americans, whether they agree or disagree with the decisions that are made with the military. And that would tend to erode a lot of public faith, especially if we've gone so far now, where a majority of Americans support open trans service. It also can cause, in my opinion, or would cause if somebody is not good enough to serve in the military, then how much easier is it to discriminate against that person in public life?
You know, Kathleen, just, I guess a similar question too. I mean, we mentioned earlier some of the statistics, and they're very hard to come up with exact numbers. But at least by some counts, the U.S. military could very well be the largest employer, largest single employer of transgender Americans in the country. Is there a responsibility there, do you think, in some ways that comes along with that?
Well, there's a study that just came out that was saying that trans are twice as likely to serve in the military, to volunteer to serve in the military, as the rest of our population. And I think that's, as was said earlier, a sense of patriotism, but it's also a sense of trying to prove who they are and that they can contribute and they're not less than or in some ways not as good as the rest of the population.
So looking forward now, I mean, we're at this moment right now, and obviously you've both had these very different experiences over very different times, but what are you looking for now? What would you like to see happen as we move forward?
I would like to see the RAND study that showed that President Trump had two concerns, disruption in the military and cost for the transition. And it's 0.1% of the military budget for cost. The numbers that have been floating around from some of the representatives in Congress are just fictional numbers. I'm delighted to hear the reaction that your unit had to you and your leadership, and I know that's been what the Air Force Academy has done, and there's no reason why we can't go forward with that in that study.
Lynette, anything you wanted to add?
Let's let facts drive policy, not emotions. Let's let, you know, knowledge push policy. And, you know, it's within the military. I feel that I've been lucky because of my timing for coming out, being at this place where it is considered acceptable and a lot more people understand. But it's also quite a fear that, you know, there's the possibility of getting pushed back into a much darker time for the military. And I hope to avoid that.
Lynette, we've only got about a minute left here, unfortunately. But, you know, I understand that when the tweet came out, as you talked about, you said you know, you had been hoping to return to active duty. What are you looking at? I mean, is this still something you want? What are your plans right now in this sort of moment of uncertainty?
You know, at the moment, I'm still kind of just waiting in a holding pattern to see where this goes. I am hopeful that it all just ends up blowing over and that current policy continues to stand and that ascension policy is put into place, which is what ultimately delayed the ascension of many of the cadets to active duty, as well as originally what delayed me from going back to active duty. But my desires have not changed. My desire to serve this country and its military is as strong as ever, and I don't see that going anywhere in the near future.
So Lyneth Starr serves in the Army National Guard. Also here in the studio with us, Kathleen Robbins, former Air Force officer. Thank you both. I appreciate you sharing your story and taking the time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I'm Scott Cameron. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media.